Okay. You're recording.
I'm recording.
Yeah. Okay. We're recording, we think. Yes. Welcome to the... Oh, it's probably about the 24th of January. All day today?
All day.
Okay. Of 2015, we're at the Narcisse Bible Study. We're going to start with a little introduction that will lead us to a broader topic. We will read a text from the Bible, and we'll ask some questions that may be disturbing to us because of Bible stories are meant to cause us to think. And they don't always come with answers. Part of the necessity of a Bible, of a one of these stories, is to engage us so that we will walk with God. But before we get there, I'm going to take a few minutes because I'm going to be lecturing to some tour guides, and I was coming up with all sorts of things that tour guides might be interested in, and so I thought I would use this as an introduction to our topic today. So you three will, here's on one side, you can look down, and on the other side you can look down, and I'm going to raise the question. I'm speaking in English, and so in English I will say, we're going to talk about the name Jesus for about 5 minutes. And, you know, where does the name Jesus come from? Well, you can say, hey, maybe it comes from Jesu, going back to Greek, Jesus. Our Gospels were written in Greek. The Greek name for our Lord is Jesus. That's the Greek name. But what was his name? Was Jesus running around preaching in Greek? No.
No.
No. So, and was his name Jesus? No. Jesus is how the name was written in Greek. But what was his name? And how do we find out what his actual name was? And in fact, we have three traditions here in the Middle East. And I've written them up on the board. And we'll briefly look at them. And we'll try to come up with an understanding which one is, you know, will the real name of Jesus please stand up? So we have Yeshua written up here. Sometimes if you're on the web, you're going to see some bogus things on the internet. Everybody can say whatever they want, and they often don't know what they're talking about. You'll sometimes see things like Yahasua. I mean, I haven't a clue how they generated such drivel. But anyway, you'll see stuff like that out there. But the three most common, and you could say responsible names in the sense that they're widely used by all levels of society, are Yeshua. And this is used, for instance, by Messianic Jews in the land here. They all refer to Jesus as Yeshua. And many times in English or others, when they want to hear the real name, you'll hear the name Yeshua. And that is found in the Bible. It was one of the most common names in the first century. It sounds like a name, like a noun, Yeshua, which means salvation. Okay, Yeshua is one of the names. Now, if you're in Israel and speak Hebrew with people, you will often hear the name Yeshu. And sometimes you'll hear it debated. You'll hear people say, oh, don't use Yeshu because these are abbreviations for Yimach Shmo. But I don't believe that, because if it was Yimach Shmo, it would just be Yimach Shmo. You wouldn't have the U here.
Vizikro. Shmo Vizikro.
Vizikro, yes, okay. Yeah, you can generate it. But our texts in the Talmud don't have it. And I think there is an easier way to generate it. I'll get to that. And there's another name. And the other name is
Isa.
And throughout most of the Middle East, when Muslims refer to Jesus. In fact, in much of the world, they refer to Jesus as Isa. And a lot of people in the West just hear that and they go, oh, that's just like, you know, English people say Jesus, then Arab background people say Isa, and there's no difference. So we're going to look at that very briefly. What was Jesus' name? Was his name Yeshua? Was his name Yeshu? Or was it Isa? And can we explain where the three different names came from? First of all, Yeshua, first century. I said it's the most common name. There are a few scholars in Israel today that now claim, mainly because they've come from the tradition where they're using Yeshu, and they know that in the Talmud it's Yeshu. There actually are scholars who...
It is in the Talmud, you said, Yeshu?
Yes, Yeshu is in
the
Talmud.
I heard it was in...
Yes, it is in the Talmud as Yeshu. And there are some scholars today that will claim that the name Yeshu is just a first century pronunciation of the name Yeshua. And they will sometimes say, we've discovered this archaeologically. And so it sounds very appealing to people. So I thought I would bring you the evidence so that you can see what it's based on. And if you'll pass that picture around, do you see this picture? This is an ossuary box. It's a bone burial box. We've got, you know, there's hundreds of these that have been discovered. They're mostly from the first century. They have sometimes writings on them, family members. We've got lots of examples of Yeshua, spelled with an I. We have inscriptions, other things, where the name Yeshua is found and spelled with an I. It is true that we have one example from the first century of Yeshu written without the I. And if you just heard that, you might think, oh, they've got good evidence. Well, look at the picture very carefully. If you will look at this picture, here's a picture of the box. And the inscription is right here, and this is a blow-up of it. You will see that Yeshu is scratched in right here in the middle columns, and it has a border on it. It barely fits in here. You've just got Yud, Shin, Vav, and it's right up against the border. Whoever it is ran out of room, and you'll also notice if you look at it... You'll also notice that it's got multiple scratchings on it. It is not clear just exactly what this author was trying to do. Whoever scratched that name in there, we do not know. This is not evidence that the name was Yeshu. This is evidence that we don't know what this scribe was doing. He put in a Y and a Sheen and a Vav, and it's not the same scribe as the rest of the box. If you'll notice the shape of the Sheen, you have a line with three lines here, and if you look next to it, you'll see the whole name written out, and it says Yeshua with the Ein at the end, Yud Sheen Vav Ein Bar Bet Resh, Yud He Vav Samech Pe Bar Yosef. Yeshua Bar Yosef. Here is the full name. This one only has two bars on the Sheen. They're different. And you'll also notice that the person doing the cutting was a lot more neater on this whole thing. Now here he had all the room in the world, and so you get a full name. Now this is the same box. So it is true that there is one example of Yud-Shin Vav in the first century, but it is not clear that that was intended to be the name. And that is the full and only evidence for Yeshu in the first century. That's it. Now, is that evidence that you can build theory on? No. Any historian, once they see the evidence, is going to have to say, no, you can't rely on that. This is ambiguous evidence. It doesn't prove anything. All it proves is you have a sloppy scribe.
Maybe his kid was saying, come on, you...
We don't know. We simply don't know what is, you know, what is there. We do have plenty of examples. There are examples of people that write and they get to the end and they run out of space. There's a famous, up in Sipori, you've all seen this beautiful mosaic in the symposium room. And, you know, the Mona Lisa of the Galilee, that beautiful face. Not many of you turned around while you were looking at this beautiful mosaic. If you turned around and looked right behind that platform, you would have seen a little tiny square room about this big. Not more than, say, a couple meters, like a meter, meter and a half square, with a tiled floor, with, you know, mosaic tiled floor, and in it was the is the word, almost the word, for your health. It was an indoor outhouse. And it says, for your health, and it was right off the symposium room. But how did they spell it? I'm going to use English now. They were writing in Greek. But they wrote it, and they ran out of space. And so they put the last letter underneath. You know, they got to the end, and they, it'd be like taking the word health and putting the H down below it. You almost can't even see the H. A lot of people see it, and they go, oh, look at that. They spelled it without the last letter. If they look more carefully, oh, yes, there it is.
Well, so, the icons are like that, too.
The point is that we do not know what this scribe was doing. We know he was sloppy. We can see all the extra scratchings. So, what was his name? What was the name of the teacher from Galilee? We know that in Galilee there were Greek speakers that would have not pronounced his name correctly, because Greek speakers can't say Yeshua. They would say Yesu. Jesus is Greek. So they would say Jesus. We've got plenty of examples of that kind of thing.
What is
his
Aramaic?
What?
What is his Aramaic?
I'm getting to that in 1 minute. We know that when the Arabs came in the 7th century and they recorded local names, they got the names right. The Ains and the Hets were still being pronounced correctly. You'll sometimes hear people say, oh, they didn't pronounce the Ains and the Hets correctly in the Galilee. There were people there who didn't pronounce them correctly, but the locals that spoke the languages did pronounce them correctly and preserved them until the 7th century. How do we know that? Because we've got lots of names that preserve the Ain and the Het in the right place, so much so that sometimes they change the name. Here's a nice one to remember. Othra. Othra, the Ain, it means, you know, like back of the neck, turn around, whatever. There are a couple places in the land where the Arabs came in and they heard the name Othra. Why were they afraid? They did not record the name Othra. They changed it to Taibe. Taibe, which means good. Nice place. Good place. Happy place. Why? Because the same consonants, Ain, Pe, Resh, are used in Arabic, and they create a little bit of fear. Ifrit. What does Ifrit mean?
Ifrit is this ghost.
It's like a jinn.
Jinn.
And Ifrit is like a jinn. It's like an evil spirit.
Wow.
So they came to a place, and its name was Othra. Oh. And they went, ho-ho-ho. Taibe. We will call this the good place. And so anyway, so yes, they could hear these, they could hear the Ains and the Hets. So in the first century, 600 years earlier, they did have all of this. Now, how do we know what the name was from Jesus? Because we have the Christian tradition. In Matthew it says, the angel of the Lord came and told Joseph, you shall call his name. Now, they weren't speaking Greek. Our record is in Greek. So the Greek record says, you shall call his name Jesus because he will save his people from their sin. Gives a meaning, gives a reason for the name. Why why Jesus? Because he'll save the people from their sin. Is there a name in Hebrew that lines up with the meaning he will save his people from their sin? The answer is yes, Yeshua. Yeshua sounds like Yeshua, salvation. So the Christian tradition from the beginning backs up Yeshua. And as we've seen archaeologically, Yeshua was the first century name. There is no evidence that would lead us to any other name. And now we get to the Aramaic. In our Gospels were written in Greek, but they were translated for Aramaic communities in the Middle East quite early. Already in the second century, there were translations made. And guess what they called Jesus in Syriac, which is a dialect of Aramaic? What did they call Jesus in Aramaic?
Yeshua.
Yeshua.
Oh, Yeshua.
Yeshua. It's exactly the same. Exactly the same. Identical. And we've got those records. They called him Yeshua. They knew when they saw Jesus, they knew that the name was Yeshua. And so in their translation, they used the correct name, Yeshua. Now, did they make it up? Maybe they made it up. These languages are close. And maybe they just wanted it to be Yeshua because it would sound like salvation. Not. What do I mean by not? Aramaic does not have a noun, Yeshua. There is no verb in Aramaic, Lehoshia, that means salvation. They used other words. In fact, when they translated that verse in Matthew, and you shall call his name Yeshua, because he'll save his people from their sin, he will give them life from their sin. The idiom in Aramaic for salvation was to give life. Because they didn't have this word. What does that mean? That means that the testimony of the translators in the second century is going back to a tradition of what the name was. It was not something that they invented or that made sense in Syriac, or quote, which is a dialect of Aramaic. This is not an Aramaic invention. This is evidence of what the name was. It was Yeshua. It's one of the most common names of the first century. So there really is no problem whatsoever with Yeshua. So where does Yeshu come from? Yeshu, it comes a few centuries later, 3rd, 4th, 5th century, Talmudic evidence. The Christians that were in the land, especially after the 2nd century, had a lot of Greek influence. You know, Eusebius was here in Caesarea, just up the coast. Origen came here from Egypt. There were large Christian communities. There were large Greek cities. There were a lot of Greek speakers here. We know there were a lot of Greek speakers because in Mishnaic Hebrew, there are literally thousands of loanwords that have come into the Hebrew language from especially Greek and also Latin. So they've absorbed all of this because there was contact. Ever since Alexander the Great, we had Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew in the land, and we had lots of Greek speakers, and the church in this land was strongly influenced by Greek because their connection to the rest of the world was in what language?
Greek.
So much so that when they did another translation into the local Aramaic dialect, in the second half of the first millennium A.D., we call it Christian Palestinian Aramaic in English, Aramita Nozrit Ha'Eretz Israelit. No, Suryoyo is different. We talked about that before you got here. That was second century in Suryoyo, and that was where we... Thank you. So, back to the time period. When we get to the Talmudic time period, we have Christians that are heavily influenced by Greek. They're still using local dialect. When Jerome was here, he said, you know what? The Jews make fun of the Christians because the Christians often mispronounce some of these words. You had so many people in the Christian communities, bilingual and primary lingual, growing up with a Greek background, that they were starting to pronounce their Aramaic differently. And it went so far that when they did this translation I told you about, between the second half of the first millennium, the name for Yeshua, they popped in from Greek, and they now called him Jesus. They were using the Greek name all over. So if you have people running around referring to Jesus, in the first century his name is Yeshua. But if you start to have a lot of people that don't speak Hebrew or Aramaic as a first language, you will start to hear the ayin dropped out. And that, I'm almost certain, is where this Yeshu comes from. People were hearing locals say Yeshu because they couldn't say Yeshua. Yes.
Doesn't Flusser think that that was already trend in the first century?
Yes, Flusser does think that, and thank you for bringing that up. So now I will name one of those scholars that I mentioned earlier that has it all wrong. And I appreciate him dearly for so much that he has given us that's been very helpful for background in the first century. But on the name Jesus, he is out to lunch.
Who's that scholar by name?
David Flusser. Yeshu is not a first century name of Yeshua.
Yeah.
Full stop.
So what is Yeshu in the first century?
Nothing. It doesn't
exist.
That's what I passed around, this picture. The only evidence you have is this picture where you get a scribbled Yeshu stuck between two lines where the guy ran out of room, and the rest of the inscription says Yeshua with the I, Yeshua bar Yosef.
To clarify, Flusser said it would always be spelled with the I. He was saying that the I was losing its pronunciation force. That was his argument.
I didn't know if he was saying that or not, but that is true. That is true of the 3rd and 4th century.
Right.
That is not true of the 1st century. And if you go and listen to Kutcher, Kutcher will say that there were influences, outside influences, especially from Greek, that were affecting the elite high levels of society, but not the low levels of society. The low levels of society were pronouncing the eins and the hets, and the first change was not to lose the ein. The first change that took place was the het changed to an ein, which would have preserved it anyway.
So those changes are happening in the 2nd, 3rd century in both the elite class and the lower class, or just the elite?
In some communities it was happening throughout, like in the Christian communities where you had a heavy influence and connection with the Greek world. By the mid-first millennium, the Christian communities were being heavily Grecized.
Right. No, but I'm talking about people here in the land.
Yes, I'm talking about Christians here in the land.
Okay.
So where did the...
That Jerome talked about.
So where did the understanding come, which goes on now, which... Most Jews who use the word Yeshu do mean, may his name be blotted out. Where does that come from?
That comes from interpreting. That's just a midrashic interpretation.
Where did that start? Because it's very well founded here.
I have no idea when and where it started exactly. But it's
the 6th century.
Sixth century.
Talmud.
Well, the Talmud is 6th century, but it's recording stuff even earlier, so you can go and date it according to the rabbis. Yeshu was a name in the Talmud.
I know
already.
You said that. Yeah.
So,
but I was wondering where the interpretation or the understanding, which is correct.
It comes from whenever Titus Yimach Shmo comes from.
Oh, very good.
Titus is the guy that destroyed Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And within Jewish culture, one of the ways you
must again.
You make fun of an enemy.
Worse than make fun.
What?
It's worse than make fun.
It's worse than make fun. As you say, so and so, may his name be blotted out.
Yes.
So Titus, his family name is Yimashmo.
But they apply
that's a joke.
They apply it to
and
Jesus.
So is Amalek.
They apply it to Jesus.
And they apply it to Jesus, and we don't have a record.
No.
Full stop.
That's what
but
I'm
it's
asking.
Natural within the culture.
Thank you.
Okay.
But it does help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A third name, and I've got to do this one in 2 minutes, because we still have the story to get to. The third name is Isa. Now, in the West, because people don't pronounce Ains, they do not know how bad the name Isa is. Look at the name Yeshua.
How confused.
Please listen. Yeshua. You hopefully can hear that Ain. I am trying to enunciate it in such a way that English speakers can hear it. Yeshua.
Yeshua.
Yeshua. And this name over here is Isa. Isa. The Ain is at the beginning of the name, not at the end of the name. It's a shibush. It's a mistake. It's a dyslexic mistake. Now, we do not know where it comes from. All we know is that it gets into the Quran. Either God made a mistake. I say that as a joke.
No, it's true.
Either it is
the God of the Islam.
Yeah, the God of Islam. Either the God of Islam made a mistake, or Muhammad wasn't hearing very well. One of the two. Now, I can clarify that a little bit. People that study history can actually, any ancient text, you can go and you can see the sources. You can see the language used, the dialect, the sources, where some of the citations are coming from. People that do that with the Quran can very clearly see where the Quran, where he got some of the ideas from the Jewish Midrashim. There's all sorts of scrambled history. You can trace it. It's very easy to do. Scholars are not befuddled by this at all. However, the Islamic world is befuddled because, according to them, the Quran was dictated word for word from heaven. This is what was written in heaven, dictated down. Now, that is not a theory of inspiration that has ever been accepted within Christian and Jewish circles. But that is a popular understanding, and that is the understanding that was in Islam. Consequently, they're stuck with Isa. Now, we happen to have the Yeshua as the name given by the angel with the meaning salvation. Where is Isa coming from? Well, it's not coming from heaven. It's not coming from an angel. It is a mistake. And historically, we don't know where it's coming from. In other words, we don't have the sources to say in the 5th century there were some people at this oasis in the Arabian desert that recorded this and that. We don't have the records. So we do not know why Isa got into the shape that it's in. We know it's a mistake. We don't know who made the mistake first, and we don't know why they made the mistake. All we know for certain is it is a mistake. It is not God's mistake, because God doesn't make mistakes. And I assume it's not Muhammad's hearing. He's got the Ain, he just has it wrong. I don't know where he got the name, but it is not Jesus' name. So, who is Yeshua? Will the real Yeshua please stand up? It's Yeshua. It's not Yeshua, and it's not Isa. Okay.
What does Isa mean?
I said we don't know. It doesn't mean anything.
It
means nothing.
There is. You heard about the Munjid. Munjid is a translator from Arabic to Arabic.
Okay.
So when you put Isa, many translations, many meanings.
Yes.
But the most important meaning is Thaban Sam. translate that to?
That means the poisonous snake.
Poisonous snake on earth is Isa.
Well, it also, Isa, if you want it, then Isa is also the name of one of the gods of the Hindus, Shiva. I mean, there's a lot of connections you can make. Like I said, we do not know. We do not know where the name actually came from. As, you know, if you want to talk about historians. What?
A dyslexic storyteller.
The point is the name is not Isa. And the name Isa is all over the Quran, and that's a mistake. It's not the only mistake.
It comes from a devil disguised as an angel. Jibril could be...
That is possible. However, since you were going there, let me fill this out a little bit. Yes, we can make a theological statement and say it comes from the devil. Because we know the devil hates the gospel, the devil hates the name Yeshua, the devil hates the Bible. So we can make a theological statement and say the devil did it. But there are a lot of things in the Quran, and we don't need the devil to explain them. For instance, at Mount Sinai, the children of Israel made a golden calf. We all know the story in the Bible. Aaron was pressed by the people, and he said, okay, get your gold, here it is, throw it in the fire, and out comes a golden calf. We know the story. In the Quran, it says, the Samaritan misled the people and with the golden calf. Now, what's wrong with that story? Well, there were no Samaritans at the time of Moses. That's what's wrong with the story. Now, did the devil teach Muhammad about the Samaritan? I don't think he need the devil involved, because I think it's very easy to explain it by simply having Muhammad in contact with Jewish teachers who like to do midrash. And where else was there a golden calf? Well, the northern kingdom of Israel. About 400 years later, we have Jeroboam of the northern kingdom misleading Israel with the golden calf. So, the northern kingdom is the kingdom that later became called the Samaritans. Now, all you need is a Jewish midrashic teacher that comes along and says, Aaron leads the people of Israel astray with a golden calf. To what may this be compared? To Jeroboam. That, quotation marks, that Samaritan who led the people of Israel astray. All you have to do is teach that, and a camel driver who happened to like to raid caravans could take that and incorporate it and now retell the story. So you don't have direct demonic visitation. You just simply have historical sources being garbled, being muddled up. Yes, okay. So, theologically, we can still say it's the devil, but that doesn't mean that we're saying that there was a direct visitation.
No, but this guy as an angel.
Yes, we agree. Listen, we are agreeing that this is demonic. It is devilish. The name Isa is devilish because it corrupts the name Yeshua. Then the Arabs, Christians today, say Yeshua. That's the normal way in Arabic to say Yeshua. You say Yeshua. That's good. Just like we say Jesus. All of that's good. Isa is a corruption. It is demonic, but historically we do not know the process. We do not know who first said it, why it was first said.
But okay? These are Israeli legends.
It probably was influenced. No, we don't even know that with the name Isa. We don't know. Yes, but let's just drop it. Since we don't know, we don't want to make a statement to say it was this or that or some other thing. We don't know. We don't have the evidence. Is it wrong? Yes, we know that. Do we know who said it first? Do we know why it was said that way? We don't know that.
But the, as well,
we know it was wrong.
The middle name as well.
Okay.
You can apply the same principle.
And the same principle here with Yeshua. Exactly. So his name is Yeshua. This took a lot longer than
what?
What? What?
Yes.
It's okay?
It's okay.
It's okay.
Okay, but now I've only got about 10 or 15 minutes for the big thing.
So this is the kernel right here.
This is the kernel. This is the, we're going to get, we're moving now to something that we're going to wrestle with for the rest of our lives, maybe, in one sense.
Can I ask one question? Is Isa used in throughout the Quran, or is it just in the Meccan or the Medina?
Throughout.
Throughout, okay.
Wherever the name refers to Jesus, it is Isa. I don't know how often the Medinan surahs mention Isa. So I would have to check on that. I just know that you only have Isa.
Mm-hmm. And correct Arabic is?
Is Yeshua.
Yeshua.
Because S, Sa, and Sha flip in lots of Arabic words. This is a normal linguistic process. Nobody is upset when that flips. I say Asir, and he says Ashura.
Yeah.
Okay? Nobody's upset.
Okay. No,
I say Tesha.
He was born.
I say Tesha. He says Tisa.
Tisa.
Okay, good. That's fine. I say Yeshua. Somebody from Cairo says Yeshua. That's good. But somebody else says, no. We heard it from God's mouth through the prophet that his name was Isa. Okay, that's rubbish. Now, I just said that's rubbish. Do you realize that there are people in the world that if they heard that would want to kill me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's going on tape.
For saying the truth that Isa is a mistake. Okay? That is a verifiable fact. Am I allowed to say, can I say that the moon is not made of green cheese?
Could do.
I can say that. I do not believe the moon is made out of green cheese. I call that a fact. I also say the earth is not flat. If there was a flat earth society that was in control of everything and threatened to kill anybody that said it wasn't flat, I would be in trouble. Because I will say the earth is not flat. The earth is round. Okay? Now, facts are things that can be debated. If somebody doesn't like it or agree with it, they can say, oh, well, let's look at the evidence. What is it based on? Can we come up with a better explanation of the evidence? I'm open to that. That's great. You come up with a better explanation of all this evidence, that's fine. But the evidence that we have and the evidence that God has given the world is that Yeshua is the name and Isa is a mistake. Okay, so how do we live in the modern world? And we've got two things out there. In the last 2 weeks, there's been a lot of debate going on, and you have two conflicting ways to deal with the debate. The debate on free speech. Can we talk about the truth? Can we say that something is false, or can we disagree? Can we make fun of the Pope? Can we draw a picture of the Pope holding up a condom, for instance? Well, that may be offensive to somebody, but it's also a kind of argumentation. And we can debate, is birth control good? Does God, you know, have we fulfilled the first commandment so far that we can now ease up on it? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Well, maybe we've kind of filled the earth, and so it's okay to ease up on the first commandment. Or maybe it's not. We can debate that. And that's fair. And that's good in civilized society. We debate it. And so, we have two ways to debate something. Can we say that Isa is a mistake? Well, one theory in our media says tough love. So, and Ayan Hirsi Ali, gave an interview a couple weeks ago and said, what the world needs now, I'm debating this, is tough love. We need to say, where is the violence coming from? Why are people killing in the name of religion? You know, who is teaching that? Why are they teaching that? How do we come underneath it and refute that teaching? And we don't care if some people are offended. This is called tough love. We must get to the roots of this teaching. We must find out who's teaching it, what is that teaching based on, and how do we refute that teaching? How do we show that that teaching is false? This is the debate that has to go on in our society. This is tough love, because some people don't want the debate to take place. That's one side of the issue. And the other side of the issue is called self-censorship. What is self-censorship? Self-censorship says, I'm not going to say anything that would make these people that like to become violent for their religion. I'm not going to offend them, so I'm going to only say things that they will not be offended with. I will censor myself. I won't say that Isa is a mistake. I will say, Isa's different. The Muslims say that. Period. I won't say it's a mistake. Because if I did, somebody in Saudi Arabia might go out and burn a car tire. Mm-hmm. We don't want that.
Kill other people over there.
They might. There were 75 churches burned in Niger.
Yes.
75 churches in the country just above your country.
Yes.
This is for the record. I'm talking to someone here from Nigeria. And 2 weeks ago and last week, just north of that country, there were 75 churches burned. That's horrible. But who is responsible? The people responsible, I think, are actually in two. The people that did the burning are responsible. The people that taught them that they can do that burning are responsible. And I think also some of the responsibility is us, the Western media or the international media that don't even want to talk about this.
Right.
The fact that we don't talk about it allows this thing to continue because we don't dig out the evil that's in the roots. There is something evil that is generating that. This is not random. There is something evil that has to be exposed. Who's teaching it? Why are they teaching it? How do we refute it and get rid of that teaching? That's the discussion. Self-censorship will not do it. Self-censorship ultimately will strangle us. Oh, by the way, I actually like President Obama. He's done some nice things. I even want his health care to work. I like that. And yes, I just was political and somebody said, you got to be kidding. Okay, I'm not. I'm not kidding. But,
way to go.
But his heart's in the right place for wanting the health care. I don't know if it can work and I don't know how to make it work. But his heart's in the right direction on that, so I'm going to support him on that. But he also came out and said, I think we need a little self-censorship. Well, I think that is a horrible solution. That is a solution that will ultimately lead to more church burnings and more violence. Because it's what is called appeasement. It's the crocodile syndrome. You just keep feeding the crocodile until finally you run out of food and it eats your hand. Churchill, today Churchill died 50 years ago. Churchill did not believe in appeasement. He said, this is going to hurt us. It's going to come back to bite us if we pretend that Hitler isn't bad. We have to undermine Hitler. Well, if we think that religious violence is okay, that's going to come back and undermine all of society. It has to be exposed. So anyway,
do you think that the Bible promotes violence?
That's what I wanted to talk about today.
Yay.
Maybe another time.
You got 5 minutes.
Exactly. So I'm going to tell you the story, and you're going to go home with it.
Part two.
Okay, maybe part two. Here is the story. Remember Gideon?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Here's a story from the Bible, and I'm telling us this story because it's supposed to make us think. I am not saying we are self-righteous and we have it all right. We do not know necessarily what is the right thing to do or how to interpret all Bible verses or stories. So here is a story. Gideon, since I do still have 7 minutes, I'm going to read it and get it right. Because when I do it by memory, I always do things just a little bit off. Here we go. That same night,
Judges
6, verse 25. That same night, the Lord said to Gideon, "Take the bull that belongs to your father, and a second bull 7 years old. Pull down your father's altar to Baal, and cut down the Asherah idol beside it. Then build an altar to the Lord your God with its stones in the right order on this high ground. Kill and burn a second bull on the altar, using the wood from the Asherah idol." So Gideon got 10 of his servants, did what the Lord told him to do. Notice, did what the Lord told him to do. And what did he do? He cut down. He cut down a religious altar, and two of them. He destroyed an altar to Baal, and he cut down an Asherah pole and sacrificed his father's bull to Baal. So, I'm sorry, to the Lord. But he
by destroying Baal and Asherah,
yes, yes, he destroyed Baal's altar, destroyed the Asherah, and then offered a sacrifice to the Lord. So,
but because he was afraid.
But wait! But the Lord is the one who told him to do that destruction, and that is part of the problem. You know, do we read that story and say, "Aha! Here's something I don't like. God doesn't like it. I'm going to go out and destroy it." Is that the take-home message of this story? I would say no, and it's easy to prove because you can look at the rest of the Bible and see that they did not take that as the overarching principle, as the take-home message. It's certainly not how the gospel is preached. Paul went into Athens and saw all the idols. He didn't get out a chisel and start banging away at all the idols. He just said, "I see you're a very religious city. But I'm here to tell you about the unknown God, not these idols. But there's another God in heaven who made the whole earth, and he's willing to forgive you for this sin." So, anyway, that's how the gospel is preached. But back to Gideon. How did Gideon, what did he do? Gideon was afraid that his family and the men might see him, so he did it at night. So he's going to obey the Lord and do it at night. So when the men of the city got up the next morning, they saw that the altar for Baal had been destroyed and the Asherah idol beside it had been cut down. They also saw the altar that Gideon had built and the second bull that had been sacrificed on it. The men of the city asked each other, "Who did this?" After they asked many questions, someone told them, "Gideon, the son of Joash, did it." So they said to Joash, "Bring your son out. He's pulled down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah idol beside it. He must die." Fortunately, his dad was smart. And Joash said to the angry crowd, "Are you going to take Baal's side? Are you going to defend him? Anyone who takes Baal's side will be killed by morning. If Baal is a god, let him fight for himself. It's his altar that's been pulled down." So on that day, Gideon got the name Yerubal, which means "let Baal fight against him," because Gideon pulled down Baal's altar. Okay, so the question is, are people allowed to destroy the religious property of other people whose religion they do not accept? Can you use this story to justify it? And if you can't, what is God doing? Why did God say, destroy it? So, is what happens in the story correct? Is it the right thing to do? Does it stand forever as the marching orders for everybody?
Listen to God, yes. Listen and obey.
To listen and to obey. So we might say that in this specific instance, and that is what commentators have said for the last 3,000 years, they've said, well, in this specific instance, we can say that this man received a prophetic word from God, and so for a specific instance, who are we to say no? However, now, today, what happens today, if somebody today says, I have a revelation from God, I'm supposed to paint signs on this church. You know that last year they had signs painted on this church. You know, somebody can do vandalism and come in here, and now we're on the receiving end of it. You know, or in Niger, some people just came in and burned down 75 churches. Do they have a right to do that? Is God happy? And how do we discuss the phenomenon in the modern world? Can we accept the Gideon story as law for our societies? And that was the question that I said does not have an easy, clear-cut answer. That's the take-home question to go away with. I don't have any problem saying that violence, especially in the modern world, in a modern pluralistic world, any kind of violence against somebody whose ideas you disagree with is wrong. Now, if they attack you, that's different. I'm not taking an absolute pacifist. If Nazi Germany takes an ideology and attacks France, France has the right to defend themselves. Not a problem. You know, if communism takes an ideology and starts attacking people, I'm not arguing at that level. What I'm saying is in our society, we do not allow individuals to go out and attack and kill other people that they disagree with, or to burn down their buildings or anything else. Yes?
But, like, last summer during the war, right, people were telling me that one guy downtown, because King David said it was a mitzvah to smash Ammonite babies' heads against the stones, it's a mitzvah to smash Palestinian babies' heads against the stones. You know, come on, you're taking, I mean, it's in the scripture, but you're taking me out of the scripture and saying this is what God wants us to do. Let me break, you know?
Yes, and even in that scripture, it isn't clear if it was intended to be literally fulfilled or whether it was hyperbole. Blessed are.
Yeah, but if you're doing that to somebody's Palestinian baby, does the father of that baby have the right to defend his baby? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. If somebody comes in to attack a baby, the father definitely has the right to defend that baby.
So you say the whole war is not one-sided, you know, because these people are saying, listen, I'm defending my children, and these people are saying, I'm defending my children.
Well, some of the people were defending their children by sending out rockets to defenseless people.
And putting them on the roof to be in danger.
The problem gets back to this point of violence. Do you sit down at a table and work out a just solution? Or do you say, no solution, we're going to kill you? That's the problem. Is the solution, we're going to kill the other person? That's the solution that the modern world finds unacceptable. Yes?
Does Desmond Tutu's book, No Future Without Forgiveness, fit in here?
I suspect, I have not read the book, but I like the title.
It's the story of how South Africa dealt with apartheid afterward.
I think that is a wonderful example. I am not a historian, so I do not know the details, but in broad stroke, that sounds exactly right on. It sounds wonderful. It sounds correct. I have heard that one of the things that happened with Nelson Mandela after he was released and after South Africa changed is he went on a campaign to preach forgiveness. He says, folks, we do not continue the violence. It was done against us, and we forgive and we stop right here. That's what I've heard. If that is true, then that is a wonderful story about how to stop the violence. Yes?
And just, the instructions were to... The first part of God's instructions sound like they're violent, but then he goes on. Those are not his only instructions. It's also to build an altar afterwards, which, you know... To take the violent part as the only part of the instructions, and that might be related to
If you're coming back to the story of Gideon, you have to ask the question that you just asked from the perspective of the owner of the altar. If you were a Baal worshiper, you just had your Baal altar destroyed. You see? Now, God, in the Old Testament, one of the things that the people were told when they left Egypt and were sent into the land, they were told that there was to be nothing to remain of the Canaanites, that this was a special judgment of God. The time of the Canaanites is over. Their sins have reached a point where I'm going to use you to judge them. So that is a special circumstance, and it's only with in such a special circumstance that we can justify what was going on. On general principles, you cannot justify it. It's wrong. But as a specific instance, you can justify it. And that, for 3,000 years, is what people have done.
Why don't we do part two next week?
Okay, maybe we can have part two, because it is a discussion that needs... It's a discussion that needs to take place, and it was... The discussion I was thinking we would have about 35 minutes for today. But we did have a good discussion on Yeshua and Isa.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay.
So we are waiting for part two.
All right. We'll wait for part two. Shabbat Shalom. Ani mevarech etchem b'shem Yeshua ha-mefursam. In the famous name of Yeshua, I bless you all. And I don't know how to turn this.